Today is October the 3rd, 1978, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General Reg Lane by Dr. R.H. Roy at UVic. Okay, Reg, you're on.
Before I pick up where I left off last week, or pick up the tale, I might digress for a wee bit, because during this time period, which actually started when I came back from Edmonton in summer of 52, I was an honorary aide-de-camp to Vincent Massey, the Air Force honorary aide-de-camp in Ottawa, to Vincent Massey. And then I had to resign from that position when I went over to the Imperial Defense College in 1955. But when I came back, the lad who took my place was transferred. And so Vincent Massey, knowing I was back in town, asked if I would come back, which, of course, was a wonderful, because I had enjoyed the association with him.
Yeah.
So I did, and went back until he finally stepped down as Governor General. So I had he was in office for 7 years, and of that 7 years, I had almost six, very close to 6 years, association with him, and it was just great. So I got to know him very, very well indeed. He was fine person, just a grand man, a gentleman and a scholar, and he loved to relax. When he did relax, which was normally with a mug of a silver tankard of beer, and just to chew the fat. He just loved that. He was just the most relaxed and enjoyable and humorous person. He really was a great man, a great Canadian.
Did he tell you any stories about Pearson or?
No, he wouldn't do anything like that. Although he used to refer to us as his family, that is the honorary aides.
Yeah.
And we had several occasions when we were all together, just Massey and the aides, and perhaps our wives. When he didn't mind what he said, and on those occasions he would come out with the odd remark about some government policy or something like that, but he would do it knowing full well he wasn't going to be quoted, and being the very interested Canadian that he was, he had opinions on everything that was going on. But it was a wonderful, wonderful period, because it gave us the opportunity to meet many, many people, as you can imagine, who came to Govan House, stayed there.
Who stand out?
Well, of course, the Queen and Philip. The Queen Mother was a charming woman. When she was over on one of her trips, there was a state dinner, and it packed in, I guess, about 12 o'clock, and the aides, after everybody had left Govan House, we all went into a room to have a final nightcap before heading home, and it was getting on 12:30, quarter to one, somewhere in there. And all of a sudden, the door opened, and it was the Queen Mother, and she came in, and her opening gambit was, as we with all those startled looks on our faces, I'm sure, her opening gambit was, she said, "Ah, I thought I heard a party going on." So she said, "May I join you?" So with that, she came in. And she had a drink, I forget what it was now, gin and tonic or something like that. Sat down, I had a drink, and chatted, I suppose, for about 20 minutes, and then said, "I really think I should go to bed." And with that, she got up and left. And it was just a delightful interlude.
Lovely.
But there were incidents like that. Massey was always careful to make sure that the staff had an opportunity to meet with any visitors to Government House, such as when Queen Elizabeth and Philip arrived on one of their trips. He before our reception, he arranged that Philip and the Queen would come down from their suites about 15 minutes early, and just meet the aides and their wives before the line started and all the formalities and everything like that. So he was very, very considerate in that way. I mean, there was no need for him to do that. And goodness gracious, it was what with the load that people who visited that place were carrying. They didn't have to do that, but Vincent Massey did that sort of thing. He was that kind of person. So it was a wonderful association with many fond memories. The opportunity to meet and talk to a lot of people, Haile Selassie. I could go on. And, well, you just take the list of the people who were at Government House. And
what about the presidents of the United States? Did you meet any
of those? No, I didn't. I guess one of the visits, I happened to be away, and which, of course, because I was still working late on nights as well. This, I should add, that this social life was on top of all the work that was going on during this time period.
Yeah.
This was an extracurricular activity.
Yeah.
And so I was away on many occasions when things happened at the Open House. But notwithstanding that, it was just a wonderful association. And it was interesting. I was attending for the Canadian Club. I was attending a citizenship court down here in town with Judge Elford, who I think just does a magnificent job in this citizenship court prior to and after the swearing in of the new Canadians. Mm-hmm. The way she speaks and how she speaks. And a few weeks ago, she quoted from something, and she said, "I want to quote from something because I think this describes more fully what being a Canadian is than I could possibly put into words." And she started to read, and I said, "That is Vincent Massey." And by gosh, when she'd finished reading, I suppose about three paragraphs, she said, "Now that was written by one of our Governor Generals, Vincent Massey," and such like that. He had such, it was such a way to the a manner in which he spoke, that when she started to read that, I had not read his book, as a matter of fact, but when she read those paragraphs, I said, "That can only be one person," and that's Vincent Massey. That sort of impression he made on me, you know.
But
a fine person.
Yeah. Well, he was an unusual type that, with his background, his experience, his own scholarly abilities, you know, he's written several books, the Massey Report on the arts, a most unusual man, most unusual.
Great shame, of course, that his wife had died. Because he was fulfilling that function as the first Canadian Governor General, and his daughter-in-law was the one who acted as the hostess on those occasions when it was necessary for him to have a hostess. But it was still, I'm sure it wasn't the same as it would have been if Mrs. Massey had been alive. I only met her once, and that was during the war, but I don't remember very much about it because this was in London, when she was running that canteen. It was just a hello, and that was it. Anyway, so much for the digression.
Yeah.
Well, the plans shop in Ottawa, we discussed the Arrow program, and there were many others that were going on, coincidentally. Programs in the way of procurement of new equipment, still an expansion or the construction, big construction program still going on at the bases, a continuation of the program that was started with the NATO expansion. For example, we were still putting in those great big cantilever hangars at some of the bases. The program was still an ongoing one, but large sums of money going into our construction programs, which was all tied into the programming and plans. The whole thing had to be tied together, as well as new equipment, the 130 program got off the ground, the 119s, the C-119s were beginning to not get long in the tooth, but they were not as adequate an airplane as we had hoped they would be as a transport airplane. As a matter of fact, they were bloody dangerous when you were flying on one engine. The engines were very, very powerful, and if you lost one on one side, all the power was coming from one side, and it had an enormous impact on the aerodynamics of the airplane, and it was a tricky bird to fly on one engine. So we wanted to get into the four-engine field desperately, and so the 130, of course, had by this time had appeared and was proven itself to be a wonderful aircraft. And so that program got going. We also had the Argus program underway and plans, although I never got too involved with any of these in detail because these were done either by the operators and the logistics people. I just was in on the planning side. Once the decision had been made to go with the procurement program, then all I had to do was fit it all into the program and make the whole thing come together, and particularly from a funding point of view, too.
Yeah.
The other one was the another airplane that was appearing on the scene was the transport airplane, the Yukon, as it became known, the first, the big four-engine transport airplane to replace the North Stars.
Yeah.
That program was launched during this time period. So there were many. The fighter program, the 101 program, began to get up off the grounds towards the end to get a replacement for the CF-100s.
Mm-hmm.
So aside from the Arrow, there were many other programs getting off the ground, going, procurement being launched, and all having to be fitted into a program,
mm-hmm.
which had to allow for old slippage in programs. It had to tie in the training. When should training start on a particular new piece of equipment, so that the ground crew were ready when the aircraft appeared on the scene? Although all that planning had to be done. Now, I don't mean to imply that I did all that. It was my job was to tie it all together. There were the trainers who did all the detailed work, and the logisticians did all their detailed work, and the financial people did all their detailed work. But someone had to drag it all together in the program, and that was my function. Director of program plans and programs.
Well, this again, you know, is most interesting. Considering your background, I mean, you had gone from the Hudson's Bay into the Air Force. You had fighter or you had pilot training. God knows you had lots of experience, but what you're getting into now is something different.
Oh yes, very.
How did you make out? Was it lucky, or what?
I don't know. I suppose you could call it. It was getting into the management field.
Yeah, really.
And it was, I suppose, just native intelligence.
Yeah.
I had developed a bit of a thing as being a bit of an organizer, and I guess my reputation as an organizer was beginning to be known. I used to always charge around saying, "Let's get organized," or something like that. And I couldn't stand things if they weren't organized. As a matter of fact, earlier on, again going back a little while, this is going back, goodness gracious, to about 47, I suppose, when somebody came up with a bright idea of building a Loran station up in the north. And there was a code name for this operation, and I was made the project officer to tie this whole thing together to get this operation up into the north and get this construction that was needed to get this thing going. And I was frustrated because every time I turned around, I found somebody wasn't doing their job. And the net result was that I would immediately usurp their authority and go ahead and do the work and then come back and put it all together as a project officer, to the point where one day my boss, who at that time was Larry Dunlap, called me into the office, and I must admit he did it with a smile on his face. He said, "Here, I've just received this memo." And I looked, and of course it was from Air Vice Marshal Sleman, Roy Sleman.
Yeah.
And the whole tone of the memo to Larry Dunlap, who was then an Air Commodore, was, "Get this character Lane off our backs and tell him to slow down and stop trying to do our job." All he's doing is he's creating more confusion than help. And I laughed. Larry Dunlap, I must admit, laughed. And he said, "What shall I tell Sleman?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, sir." I said, "If we're going to meet the deadlines we've got, you can tell him he's got to get his people to work a little harder." So he laughed, and that was the end of it. But I think, probably indicated sort of the if you like, reputation, if that's the word, that I was developing as an organizer. Because things like putting together what I mentioned was the program of activities, this document which I designed and had adopted by the Air Council and accepted right throughout all the commands, as a matter of fact, because everybody had to get a copy of it. And it really was an attempt to try and drag all this stuff together, where in one document it was all laid out. And if you wanted an answer, you'd go to it and get it. And if it wasn't there, then the chances are 10 to 1 that you weren't going to get it anywhere. It just wasn't available.
Yeah.
So I fell into it. I enjoyed it. It was hard work, but I did enjoy it. Enjoyed it immensely. And as a result, I suppose, of having done that, got into the position where I was promoted to be chief of plans and intelligence from that directorate in the planning organization, which was a surprise because I was still quite young. This is now 58, so that I was still only 38 years old, and here I was being in peacetime, being promoted to the rank of Air Commodore.
Yeah.
When the retirement age for Air Commodores or for Air Officers was 55, so I still had an enormous number of years ahead of me. So that my promotions were coming still relatively fast.
Mm-hmm.
But I was, of course, delighted. Although the job of Chief of Plans and Intelligence was a particularly difficult one, because we're now getting into the age of the nuclear weapons and this sort of thing.
The
agreement for nuclear weapons, the NORAD agreement, all these things were all coming, had come to the fore just before I actually took over as Chief of Plans, so that I was in the position of being on the receiving end of an awful lot of what happened, and the political rebuttals that were continuing, and many, many, many of the newspaper articles that were being written to all of these things.
Well, now, what is your new responsibility here, Reg, as Chief of Plans and Intelligence?
Well, as the name implies, the organization was actually relatively simple. There were three and then four directorates in the organization of Chief of Plans and Intelligence. There was a director of policy, a director of plans, international. The international one primarily was the Permanent Joint Board of Defense and the Military Cooperation Committee and NATO, that sort of thing, but plans. And then Director of Air Plans and Programs, which is the one I had had, and then the Director of Intelligence. In other words, all of the Air Force intelligence was a part of that organization.
Yeah.
And intelligence in those days was a fairly big shop. We even had enough depth in the organization to do some technical intelligence work, which was rather interesting. And during that time, it was our attaché who managed to get the first photograph, and it was just pure chance that he got it, of the new German, the new USSR bomber that they were developing. And all the intelligence world knew the Russians were working on something, but they weren't too sure what it was going to look like. Mm-hmm. And by golly, if our lad didn't get a photograph of it, just on a casual visit past the base, and how the hell it happened, we still don't know, but he got it.
Oh, yeah.
And that created, when we got the film and had it developed in Ottawa, that sure created a stir. We had people up from Washington within 24 hours pouring over this and discussing it and what have you, and making use of the information.
Yeah.
But that was the organization. So it was really plans, programs, and intelligence. And plans, I mentioned international plans and PJBD and the Military Cooperation Committee, and anything of a major nature that required to go to cabinet probably came up from the plans organization, because you always had to start with a broad plan and a broad policy and approval. For example, when the time came for... let me start again. There was great pressure and a lot of opposition to the number of Americans who were in Canada.
Yeah.
Great efforts being made to get the Americans out.
Aye.
But to get the Americans out meant that we had to have people to take over the jobs they were doing, and this was not easy. But one of the deals that we did cook up, the Americans were still manning several of our radar stations, and this is when the 101 deal first appeared on the scene. And it was at the PJBD and or Military Cooperation Committee, and then at the PJBD, when the idea came up of swapping 101s for the manpower which we would provide to take over the manning
of the radar stations from the Americans, which from our point of view, and that would be spread over X number of years, because the value of the machines and the equipment we would receive, of course, far exceeded the annual pay of the Americans that we were replacing. But over a period of time, and the period we worked to was 10 years, then we more than offset the value of the equipment we were getting. Of course, from a Canadian point of view, the great value of this was that it got Americans out of Canada. And that was really the name of the exercise. I think we didn't put it quite so bluntly to the Americans, but they were under no misunderstanding of what the hell we were doing.
Yeah.
They knew what it was, because they were just as allergic to the criticisms that were going on, and the paper reports on why do we have to have the Americans in Canada, all this sort of thing. So they were to them it was probably an easy way out too. And I should also add that, curious enough, at the same time there was also a great deal of pressure in the United States to bring boys home. There was still a lot of that. Why have we got these people all over the world? Why can't we have them back in the continental U.S. and so on? It went. Well, that one cooked up, but it kind of hit the fan in an awful hurry. Let's see, I'm just trying to think who was minister at the time. It would be about 60. I guess it would be about 19. No, it'd be about 59 or 60 when this blew, because I happened to be working late in my office. It was about 8 or 8:30, and fortunately I had my stenographer still working. When the controller of the Air Force, a lad by the name of Cy Kornblatt, who has since died, came into my office with the Assistant Secretary of the Cabinet, and he said, "God, thank God you're here." And I said, "Why? What's happened?" And he said, "The Minister and the PM have agreed to the 101 swap deal, as we can refer to it."
Mm.
He said, "We've got to have a cabinet submission prepared tonight, distributed tonight to the cabinet members, because it's on the agenda for tomorrow morning's meeting at 9:30. So he said, "We've got to do a submission now." And I said, "Holy mackerel." I said, "A cabinet submission." And again, I should digress for a second. To get a cabinet submission normally took the better part of a month, because it would be drafted.
Yeah.
Then it would go up through the line and then be redrafted and shot back down again and then redrafted. And then it would have to go up through the Chief of Staff Committee. And after the Chief of Staff Committee, it would have to go to the Minister, the Deputy Minister and the Minister. So it took a long time before you actually got a piece of paper and that finally went forward with the Minister's signature on it to Cabinet. So I said, "All right, I guess it proves that the system can work when the panic signals are up." I said to Cy and to the Assistant Secretary, and I can't remember what his name was now, but I said, "All right, I think I know the story." Well, I did. I knew the story very well, because I'd been up to my eyeballs in the whole thing. I said, "I'm going to start dictating to my secretary, and I'm just going to rattle it right off. And you interrupt, because you have just come from a meeting, and I don't know what transpired at that meeting. I don't know whether there were any changes made. But let me give it as I know it, and then you make corrections. But we're only going to be able to do this once, because if we're going to hit this runoff, by the way, meantime, I'd asked my secretary to phone sergeants from the office to come charging in, because it was going to have to be runoff on a machine, duplicate." So I started to dictate, and I went through the whole bloody thing, the background, the proposal, the costing, the timing, the whole yards. And I, of course, had to be condensed down into what was a cabinet submission, which is normally not more than one page.
Right.
And here we're talking about a hell of a thing. When I finished, I said to Cy, "That's it." And he said, "That's it. That's good." And he turned to the secretary and said, "Have you got any comment?" And the secretary said, "No." So I said to my stenographer, I said, "Type it on a stencil. We'll read the stencil, because it might just look a little different when it's on a stencil." She typed up the stencil. We read it.
we went over it, three of us went over it again together, because it only took her about, I don't know what, 20 minutes, half an hour to type it in. And in the meantime, we were talking about what had happened, because there was great excitement. These two characters were up pretty high on this thing, because this was a big deal for the Air Force. Well, she brought it in, and we looked at it, and by golly, we didn't change a thing. Didn't change even a comma. And by this time, the NCO was in, and it was run off. Oh, I'm sorry. The stencil then, Kornblatt and the secretary rushed off to the minister, because I forgot to mention the minister was waiting in his office for this.
That'd be perfect.
That's right. I guess it would be. To sign this thing.
Yeah.
So it could be produced. Well, by golly, he came back, and again, no comment. That was fine. He accepted it just as it was written. Well, God, we ran the thing off, and we then by this time had drivers called in because it had to be distributed by hand to the cabinet. And the next morning, I came into work. I guess it was, of course, I don't know, by the time we got wrapped up that night, I suppose it was 11 or 11:30, and I came in early the next morning, waited, and wondered what the hell was going on, some fear and trepidation, because even the chief hadn't seen this thing. Kornblatt phoned him and told him what was going on, but it was too late. He couldn't come in. There's no time for him to look at the damn thing. And, geez, I got a call about 11 o'clock, and it was from Kornblatt, who kept in close touch with the cabinet secretary. Geez, the thing had been approved. Well, of course, I felt terrific, because the thing had gone through, no hiccups, no questions that the minister wasn't able to defend. In other words, the information they needed was on the piece of paper, and it went zip right through. So I was very elated over that. I wouldn't like to try and dictate cabinet submissions in one go very often, I can tell you. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. Not, I forget the total sum of money, but I think there was something like $170, $175 million riding on that piece of paper, and to certainly just wrap it all up in, and some nearly 2,000 troops. So to wrap that all up in and push that forward, knowing that it could be, if it was wrong, or if it had the wrong, something was missing from it, the whole thing could have either been deferred or gone down the drain. So it was a risky thing, but it worked, and of course I felt great because it had gone through.
Where did the idea come from?
I think, well, it came out of the plan shop, and who actually thought of it, I don't know. We used to barnstorm an awful lot. That's what planning is, and a lot of it is you get your senior staff in, or one of the directorates, if it's his specific responsibility, and a couple of his staff, and you sit down and say, look, we've got a problem. Okay, what are we going to do? And so you start to just kick it around. And then normally after an hour's bull session, it's surprising what would come out of it. Someone would spark something and then say, gee, you know, we could perhaps do something along those lines. Now, let's check that out. What about the technical aspects of that? Or it would be, what about the intelligence aspects of it? Well, we'd get the people who would theoretically have the answers, and we'd bring them in and get their opinions. And through this process, you get down to the point where, you know, I think we've reached something where we can put something on paper. Okay, let's get it on paper and see what the hell it looks like. Mm-hmm. And then we'll try it for size, because right now it sounds good.
Run it up
the
flagpole,
and that's exactly what you would do. And you'd start with nothing, and after never cease to amaze me how that worked. The times when I have been absolutely stuck, just didn't know which way to turn, and call in the gang and say, here's the problem, what do we do? And then someone would say, gee, I don't know, boy, we've done everything. Well, what other angles are there? There's got to be something. And then after a few minutes, somebody would say, gee, you know, there may be one thing we haven't quite considered yet. And throw it out of the table. Well, God, the first thing you know, you came up, maybe not the best answer in the world, but at least it was a solution. And God, it was just incredible. And I found that was a good way to work, and I developed that sort of a system from there on. When I got out into the commands, quite often we'd have a problem in the commands. And the same thing, I'd call in the staff, senior staff, or I might even call in a couple of the base, the wing commanders, and say, okay, they'd say, what do you want me for? And I'd say, I don't know, I'll tell you when you get here.
you know about as much about it as I do at the moment, so just get in here.
Yeah.
And then I get in and just throw it out on the table. Same thing, just sit and chew it over and chew it over, and then have someone who would be designated as sort of secretary.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
finally say, all right, let's put that on paper. Now, it didn't always work, but I was amazed the number of times it did work.
Well, tell me, where would you be at the time when the question of the bull marks came up?
The question of the bull mark, I was in the plan shop. I was there at that time when the bull marks came up. But the question of the nuclear warheads was handled by my predecessor, Chief of Plans and Intelligence. He actually was in the chair when the decision on the nuclear weapons was taken. So I personally didn't get too involved with all the ramifications of that as it was going on. In other words, a policy decision to go for nuclear weapons.
Reg, wasn't it a matter really, insofar as the Bomark's concerned, that if you were going to get the Bomark II, that the weapon, that's how it came?
Oh, it had to have a nuclear warhead.
Yeah.
That's right. But the Bomark, you're quite right, you said the Bomark II. But at the same time, there was an option on the Bomark. You could put an ordinary warhead in, but there was no point in putting an ordinary warhead on it. Because the idea, again, and the point we have to keep driving home to cabinet all the time, and the whole purpose of nuclear weapons was to not knock down a bomb or disable it. It was to disintegrate them.
Right, yeah.
And its weapons that were on board. And that was awfully hard to convince to sell people. I don't know why they felt that it was necessary to have... I don't know why it was, they felt and would argue against technological fact. If you were just to use ordinary conventional warheads, you might shoot it down, but he would dump his load. And in dumping his load, it'd be just a catastrophe. But if you fried him, then he wouldn't have a chance to dump his load.
But I wonder if he'd have a chance to dump, you know, the Bomark, from what I gather, was amazingly accurate.
It was.
Get within the metal, well, very, very close, as you know.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Follow the damn thing all over the place.
Yeah.
Would he have time even to dump?
No, he wouldn't. Not with a Bomark. But No. I'm sorry. You're differentiating between a Bomark with a conventional warhead and a Bomark with a nuclear warhead.
Well, the one or the other.
Well, no. The nuclear warhead, you're quite right on the accuracy.
Yeah.
But the point is that if it was an ordinary warhead, it might have hit him. It might have hit him somewhere in a wing, knocked a wing off. Without necessarily shooting him down or disabling the crew,
yeah.
So they could. It would, and so prevent them from taking any dumping action. This was what you had to do. You had to be sure that the crew were literally.